Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. We thank you so much for listening. Just a few days out from the Democratic caucus in Nevada and the Republican primary in South Carolina, unlike the Democrats, the GOP race is still fractured and split among several candidates: Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush. But there's a growing question among party officials whether any of them is viable. And viable here means having enough delegates to be nominated at the party convention in Cleveland in July. If not, there's a slim chance that they could end up with a contested convention where no candidate has the required 1,237 delegates to clinch the nomination. The chairman of that convention is House Speaker Paul Ryan, and he says, don't worry about it.
I think all this talk about broker conventions and who's up and who's down is all ridiculous. We've got plenty of qualified people running for president, and I think a good person will emerge from that field because the Republican primary voter will make sure that that happens.
Ridiculous? Maybe. Reporter fantasy? Definitely. And it was reported this week, however, that a monthly dinner among party elites, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and RNC Chairman Reince Priebus, included talk of the possibility of a contested convention. So the question is, what would a contested convention look like? Would Donald Trump be able to negotiate his way to the nomination, or would the Republican establishment try to prop up someone else? Here to help us understand some of the rules and the history behind contested conventions is Joss Putnam. He's lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He specializes in campaigns and elections. Joss Putnam, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
So, political journalist fantasy or real thing? It's unlikely, but could a contested convention happen?
Well, anything's possible, I suppose. But regardless of this, we talk about contested conventions every 4 years, just about. So, and we're talking about it again this time. What I urge folks is to realize this is a sequential process, right, that we go from Iowa to New Hampshire to South Carolina to Nevada and so on and so forth. And what that means is that we're constantly weighing who the winners and losers are. And that's a far different experience than if we were all states were voting on the same day.
So let's look at the history very quickly. It's been decades since this has happened. For Democrats, it was 1952 when Adlai Stevenson needed three ballots to get the nomination. The GOP hasn't had a contested convention since 1948 when Thomas Dewey, governor of New York, took three ballots as well. So it has been decades. And these days, political conventions are really packaged infomercials. They're not like conventions of old. What would lead to this? What would have to happen? Donald Trump continues to get 30% of the Republican vote, and the establishment candidates like Rubio and Jeb Bush just split the rest with Cruz in there as well. Is that what has to happen?
Essentially, yes. I mean, again, given that this is a sequential process, we tend to see the field of candidates winnow over time. If that doesn't happen, it raises the chances that no one gets to that 1,237 delegates that you mentioned before.
So then we're on the floor. You need 1,237. What happens? There's a vote. Nobody gets to 1,237. Then what? Take us behind the pipe and drape curtains. What do the negotiations look like?
Well, you know, given what the RNC has said so far, I don't know that we really know how that would work. It certainly would not be like what we saw back in the 40s and 50s. There are no brokers as in the days of old. Right now, what we'd see is that, as you said, right after the first ballot was inconclusive, it would go to a subsequent vote, and again, it would be up to the delegates to coordinate this, up to the candidates and their campaigns to coordinate this on the floor of the convention. It would be a huge undertaking on their parts and very messy at that.
Well, you know, it makes you wonder, as chaotic and potentially problematic as this would be to take place on television in front of the whole world, maybe this is what the party wants, Josh Putnam. If they can't defeat Trump and Ted Cruz, the two people they want the least, maybe this is the best last-ditch effort.
Well, you know, if Trump is stuck at 30% and is not growing that, then if the field of candidates winnows down to two, then that 30% is a losing share of the vote. That's one way that an establishment candidate could win, or any other candidate for that matter. But the RNC and others, the campaigns themselves are planning on this as a possibility as well, that if things are inconclusive, they've got to plan for this, plan B, essentially.
Plan B, and we should add, it doesn't have to be someone who's been in the race so far, right? Let's fantasize for a minute. Speaker Paul Ryan rides to the rescue to be the nominee on the floor. I don't know. Maybe they reach for Jeb Bush for some other Republican, Nikki Haley, who hasn't been in the race.
Sure. I mean, it can happen. It's difficult to imagine, I think, how that emerges, again, given the mechanics of this on the floor of the convention, that you're trying to get 1,237 folks on the same page. You've really got to have a near consensus candidate to do that. Paul Ryan may be that. Nikki Haley may be that. It's hard to see Jeb Bush being that with the delegates. But
Josh Putnam, before I let you go, you know, let's just say political conventions have become infomercials. They're awful. I know it's unlikely, but this would be awesome, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be great?
Well, sure. I'd be lying to you if I said it wouldn't be fun. But I'm a rules person. I like to see them work.
Josh Putnam is a rules person, and the rules could, however unlikely, come into play on the floor of the Republican convention if they can't get behind one candidate by then. He's a political science professor at the Department of Political Science at the University of Georgia. Josh Putnam, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
To any candidate who wants to avoid a contested GOP convention, winning in South Carolina on Saturday will be key. And to win in South Carolina, you need evangelical votes. Conservative Christians make up more than half of the GOP electorate in South Carolina, and that should be prime territory for presidential contenders like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and Ben Carson, who've espoused their religious conservatism for a long time. But Donald Trump, who has a record of statements decidedly not in line with social conservatism, still has a strong lead in South Carolina and lots of evangelical support. Trump came in second among evangelicals in Iowa. That puzzled plenty of pundits. Trump never bothered to discuss religion much at all before he became a GOP candidate. Pastor Mark Burns is an African-American evangelical pastor in South Carolina who has voted in the past for Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. Now he's throwing his support behind Trump. And in the lead up to the primary this weekend, he's crisscrossing the state to share the word with fellow evangelicals that Trump should be their candidate. Pastor Burns, thanks for joining us.
Great. So glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, what's your pitch? Why Trump?
Well, Trump is a person who is, number one, not been bought out by big businesses and private entities. And so, therefore, he's a person that's not been toyed by special interest groups. And he's really a person of the people, for the people.
So that's really interesting, Pastor Burns, because you would expect for an evangelical pastor such as yourself that support for a candidate wouldn't be based on, you know, not being able to be bought out by special interests and super PACs. I mean, Ted Cruz's campaign is playing Donald Trump in his own words, saying he's pro-choice and always has been. Does that not matter anymore?
Well, it absolutely matters. I think what's important is that evangelicals are really tired of people coming here to South Carolina, politicians who are part of the established political system coming to South Carolina and doing the song and dance routine and singing the hymnals and getting in front of church congregations and declaring their faith. But then once they get to Capitol Hill, once they get to Washington, D.C., their liberal views become evident, such as what happened with current President Barack Obama. But Donald Trump is a person who is coming from outside of the establishment that is really has captured the attention of evangelicals because he has declared we Christians will have a friend in the White House. Mr. Trump is coming from outside of the political establishment, and he's positioned himself to be able to actually keep his word.
Boy, Pastor Burns, this has to be frustrating for Senator Cruz. I mean, a lot of what you're saying is Ted Cruz's pitch. He's religious. He's conservative. He's a Christian conservative. He always has been, and he always will be. That's the subtext of his entire campaign. It's not working for you.
Well, it's because he's polished. He's routined. Again, those of us in South Carolina and evangelicals across this country, we really want somebody that won't do the same dance, that won't do the same scripted speech, just to try to win over our votes.
Well, Pastor Burns, the question has to be asked, and I assume that you think about this yourself. What would Jesus do? I mean, the eye of that needle is getting awfully crowded if Donald Trump tries to fit through it. Am I right?
Well, I think what would Jesus do would be just exactly what Mr. Trump is doing in a more contemporized manner. I really think Mr. Trump comes across as someone that has been redeemed. Again, I don't think Donald Trump is qualified to get in anybody's pulpit and begin to preach a sermon about Jesus. Or he can show his love, but I don't think he's qualified to get in nobody's pulpit and start pastoring that church. All right. So we understand that he is not a pastor, because we're not voting for a pastor. We're really voting for honesty. And that's the key. We're voting for someone that we can trust. And if they say to me, Pastor Burns, you'll have a friend in the White House as a Christian. I believe we're moving away from some of the principal core values that has made this country great again. And one of those core values was Christianity.
Pastor Burns, Donald Trump appeared on MSNBC in a town hall last night, and there was part of it that was kind of shocking to me, or I should say part of what wasn't in it. There was a shooting at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in your town last year where several worshipers were murdered. We all know that. It didn't come up at all in that town hall, and I wonder if it concerns you that candidates aren't talking about it in South Carolina.
Well, I think in South Carolina, we really want to heal in South Carolina. We want to, you know, we don't want to be labeled and branded. There's so much racial division in the country. We really want to heal. We want to get past that. I think the president and the country and South Carolina has grieved, and we have addressed the issue, the horrible incident that took place with the Charleston 9 in Charleston, South Carolina. And we have all come to Charleston to try to heal the great city. But now we want to move on. I believe Mr. Trump is focusing on the future of our country. He has a heart for the African-American people, and that's why I'm there. I haven't sold myself out. You know, I get these comments, you know, I've been paid by Donald Trump. I see his money and et cetera, et cetera. And that's horrible to even think that I haven't sold myself for 30 pieces of silver, nor do I feel like I need to defend myself. I believe the Holy Spirit has led me on this course to help bring unity where there's division.
The Republican South Carolina primary is on Saturday, and GOP candidates are working hard for evangelical votes. Pastor Mark Burns is an evangelical minister who says that his vote is with Donald Trump. Pastor Burns, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. God bless you all.
The World Health Organization is asking for $56 million over the next 4 months to combat the Zika virus. Zika has already spread to 39 countries and has been linked to birth defects in Brazil, where a public health campaign to combat the mosquito-borne virus is underway. Environmental reporter Carolyn Beeler is in Brazil for PRI's The World and its Across Women's Lives series. We caught up with her on the streets of Santana, a neighborhood just outside of Sao Paulo.
There are teams of health workers accompanied by military members going door to door to talk about standing water and mosquito control here. These kinds of interventions are happening every single day here in Sao Paulo, and sometimes the military is sent along to try to sort of add an air of authority to encourage people to open up the doors and listen to the messages that public health workers are bringing.
What kind of reactions are you hearing from residents as they get their doors approached by public health authorities, reporters, and military personnel?
Well, it is sort of a big group that's going up to each door, you know, a couple health workers, one or two members of the military, and then, yeah, there are some reporters here. I would say that generally in Sao Paulo, I am hearing from folks that they're taking this standing water issue seriously. But I was recently in a city about 3 hours northwest of Sao Paulo earlier this week, in a city called Araraquara. And a researcher there named Adriano Mondini, who's going around door to door, kind of similarly testing people and mosquitoes for Zika and dengue, he was sort of skeptical that the message was trickling down to the public, at least in that city about 3 hours away from here.
People are worried about repellents. They are worried about using long sleeves. They are worried about everything but trying to stop breeding sites, you know, trying to stop the infestation of the mosquito.
Carolyn, is there a risk here that the anti-mosquito strategy is so complex that it gets people overwhelmed? There's, of course, covering up. There's repellents. There's mosquito nets. There's standing water, all combined with, you know, the potential fear of birth defects. Is there any sign that people are overwhelmed, or are they kind of taking the advice in stride?
I would say that people aren't generally overwhelmed. I'd say pregnant women are the ones that are most likely to be taking precautions to avoid mosquito bites. But among the general public, at least here in Sao Paulo, people are still more concerned with dengue than they are with Zika. Dengue is carried by the same mosquito that carries Zika, the Aedes aegypti. And I was in a favela over the weekend, and people there were saying that they're more concerned with dengue. So it seems like people sort of get the mosquito control message. And sort of, I guess, the silver lining to this is that they're both carried by the same mosquito, and the same precaution measures should be taken for each. So, you know, if you're fighting one, you're fighting the other.
So in many ways, what you're saying is the message really isn't new. This part of the world has battled against dengue fever for a long time. It's a potentially very serious disease. This is a new threat, but really with kind of the same remedies.
That's exactly right. And this public health work that's going on right now, this door-to-door work, that's actually been going on in Sao Paulo for years and years. The military just started accompanying workers last summer, but this kind of work has been happening here.
And for the researchers, Carolyn, who've been battling mosquito infestations for a long time in Brazil, what are they saying about this new push on an old problem?
Well, you know, another sort of bit of silver lining here is that mosquito-borne illnesses are not the sexiest thing. There's not always a lot of willingness to throw a lot of money at this problem. And with Zika being in the news, there is sort of fast-tracked funds being made available here in Sao Paulo and elsewhere in the country, and sort of more attention being paid to this. So there's a network of researchers working together to improve right now the basic understanding of the Zika virus, in addition to all of this sort of more on-the-ground work. So earlier this week, I visited a University of Sao Paulo lab where a mosquito researcher named Dr. Margaret Capurro described sort of this all-out push against Zika, I thought, really well.
I always say that about mosquitoes or about the dengue or the disease, we need to think as a general. It's a war. We need to send everything that we have, not only soldiers.
That researcher says you need to send everything that you have, and it makes me wonder, Carolyn Beeler, in this part of the world where funds can be short, is this really all about personal protection and mosquito control? Do they have any expectation of a vaccine anytime soon, or are they not even thinking about that?
There is a lot of talk about a vaccine, but, you know, that's not going to happen anytime soon. A lot more people are going to get sick from dengue and from Zika before, you know, a vaccine appears. So really the focus right now in terms of what people can do for themselves is protecting themselves from mosquito bites.
Carolyn Beeler, describe if you can some of the scenes that you've seen maybe around or inside homes. Are you encountering residents with cans of bug spray everywhere, or long sleeve shirts, or brand new mosquito nets in the house? What does it look like to everyday people?
You know, it's a hot city, and it's summer right now, and so people are not generally all covered up. I know that a lot of pregnant women are covering up more than they normally would, but mosquitoes are sort of an ongoing threat here, and I haven't seen a lot of people sort of all the way covered up. There are some of the houses I've been in, you know, it does seem like people are really paying attention to standing water. So a lot of houses are being kept sort of very, very neat and tidy and very aware of the standing water problem. Of course, others, you know, it's less of a priority. They're less concerned. And so they have sort of normal puddles and water pooling near dishes and stuff like that.
And so, Carolyn Beeler, before we let you go, you know, if there's lots of experience with mosquito-borne diseases like dengue, that means public health workers have lots of experience with apathy. Their messages only go so far. Are they getting through more effectively now than they ever did with dengue, or do they encounter the same mixture of enthusiasm for their message, but also, yeah, guys, go away, I'm going to get on with my life?
You know, I would say that the public health workers really are trying to capitalize on this Zika problem and sort of use that as a new attention-getting hook from people. But it's hard to say whether that's really working for each individual Brazilian here.
On the ground with the public health teams trying to battle Zika virus and mosquitoes in Sao Paulo, Brazil, Carolyn Beeler, environmental reporter and producer for PRI's The World. Thanks so much, Carolyn.
Thank you.
This week, we've been exploring how the water crisis in Flint, Michigan has raised questions about the state of our water supply. And we'll talk to residents of one New York town who are facing a similar crisis later on this hour. But most of us don't have to worry about our drinking water. Even so, Americans consume more bottled water than any other country in the world. We buy an estimated 500 million plastic bottles of water every week, and many of them end up in landfills. The city of San Francisco is trying to reverse this trend. It's introduced a ban on the sale of single-use plastic water bottles on city-owned property. But environmentally friendly San Francisco is actually following the lead of a much smaller town in Massachusetts. The Takeaway's WGBH producer Elizabeth Ross has our story.
Concord's a historic town about 20 miles west of Boston. It's known as the birthplace of the American Revolution, and another revolution was started here 3 years ago after residents voted to ban the sale of single-serve plastic water bottles.
Bottled water is a scam.
It was Jean Hill's idea. The 88-year-old says she was inspired by her grandson.
He said, "You know, Grandma, there are big things circling around in the water that are as big as Texas, and they're full of plastic trash." And I finally realized that these gyres, these circular currents, are full of plastic trash. And there's a fish called a lanternfish that eats it. Then it gets in the food chain.
Even with widespread recycling, an estimated 2 million tons of plastic water bottles end up in landfills every year. Jean was convinced that banning the bottles was the best way to tackle the problem. But she says the International Bottled Water Association fought her tooth and nail, and some local merchants were also against it, including the owner of the local grocery store, Crosby's Marketplace. But once the ban eventually passed, Crosby's and all the businesses here complied. When I visit Crosby's in Concord, I meet store manager John Cummings. He takes me to an aisle where there's just a fraction of the water you'll typically see in most grocery stores.
Basically, what we're allowed to sell is anything that they deem cannot come out of a tap. So anything that has a flavor, we're allowed to sell at any size. And any plain water, we're allowed to sell in a 1.5 liter bottle or more.
Residents sometimes complain about the ban because it allows small bottled sugary drinks to be sold, but not healthy water. The ban that San Francisco is phasing in over 4 years isn't as far-reaching as Concord's. It won't stop retailers selling bottled water in their stores. The ban only applies to public, not private property. But advocates see it as an important first step. And Concord residents are full of advice for San Francisco or any city or town that wants to make a bottle ban work. First of all, they say, you have to put in a lot of these. Water fountains. San Francisco's working on that. In Concord, town manager Chris Whalen points out plenty of fountains and filling stations.
When the ban took effect, we replaced the old-style one with one here that has a refilling station, can also fill dog bowls, so people use it for providing water for their dogs as well. And then it's adapted for the disabled in a wheelchair. It's accessible for those folks, for kids, and then the traditional bubbler. So there's three spigots there. It can handle multiple uses.
But there's just one problem.
Is it operating today?
Probably not. Let me check and see. I think not.
This won't be an issue in sunny San Francisco, but during the long New England winter months, Concord has to turn off all its outside water fountains to stop the pipes from freezing. And that's where some of the local businesses help out. Many offer tap water free of charge through a marketing initiative called Concord on Tap. Jill Appel worked on Concord's ban, and she says branding your tap water is the best way to go.
I would recommend that San Francisco focus on, you know, the high quality of its own tap water. We've all been subjected to about 30 years of marketing, aggressive marketing by the bottled water industry, to make us distrust our tap water, when I think the truth is exactly the opposite.
Some people drink bottled water because they think the quality is better. But that isn't necessarily true. Lawmakers in San Francisco say it's estimated that up to a third of bottled water is repackaged tap water. They say billions of dollars have been invested into their region's water system, and they're on a mission to educate local residents about how pristine and cheap it is. For The Takeaway, I'm Elizabeth Ross in Concord, Massachusetts.
The water crisis in Flint, Michigan was a surprise to a lot of people, outside of Flint anyway. But though it's gotten a lot of attention in the media, Flint isn't alone. The small community of Hoosick Falls, New York, about 40 miles northeast of Albany, has a poisoned water crisis of its own, and the residents there are now in a confrontation because of their demands for safe drinking water. The first official warnings came back in December when the Environmental Protection Agency advised Hoosick residents against drinking and cooking with water in their village. The water was found to have high levels of perfluorooctanoic acid, otherwise known as PFOA. It's a chemical used in everything from Teflon to food wrappers. Well, last week, the State Department of Environmental Conservation named Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics and Honeywell International as the two companies responsible for the PFOA contamination. Saint-Gobain is the village of Hoosick's largest employer. Michael Hickey is a resident of Hoosick Falls. His father worked at Saint-Gobain and passed away from kidney cancer 3 years ago. It was 14 months before the EPA warning that Hickey suspected his father's death might have something to do with exposure to PFOA. Michael Hickey joins me now. Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Explain how the contamination in Hoosick Falls water was first detected.
I started reading into this in late January, early February of 2014. One of our local teachers passed away, which a short time after my father did. And there's always been kind of a thought in Hoosick Falls that we've had high levels of cancer. So after the teacher passed away, it was a basic Google search. I looked at one company first that used kind of more regulated chemicals, Oak Mitsui, with all the zines that they really test for down there. But then I looked into Saint-Gobain, and my dad worked there for 32 years as well. So all I typed in was Teflon and cancer. So I continued to read about it for 2 to 3 months. Then I sent it to one of our local doctors to see if there was anything to it. He read through some of the information and he thought maybe we should follow through on it. I contacted the mayor shortly after that in August of 2014 to see if they were able to test for it. They were unable to. So I followed through and I found the lab that DuPont used for all their testing in British Columbia, Canada, which is called Axis Analytical. I ordered a kit at that point in time. They sent one to my home a few weeks later after that. Then I followed up again with the mayor and the Department of Water supervisor because it was calling for 2 raw samples of the water. When I called them, they wouldn't allow me to have the raw water samples. The mayor informed me that private citizens did not have access to raw samples as such. So I took a sample from my sink, my mother's sink, and then I went to the local McDonald's and dollar store and took 2 samples from there as well because they were on private wells. Sent out the water. I came back a few weeks after that with levels over 480 at my house and 540 parts per trillion at my mother's house. The EPA guideline at that point in time was 400 parts per trillion, which we were obviously above. Contacted the mayor again and informed him of the results. They ran their first test in October of 2014. The results came back October 16th of 2014. Pretty much mirroring my first results.
And you basically felt after your testing that the mayor either slow-walked this or brushed it aside?
Correct. Because finding it in August of 2014, the unfortunate part here was that it's an unregulated contaminant, yes, but there's been enough research and science on this to know that it's not good.
We should point out here, Michael Hickey, that the EPA has named Saint-Gobain and Honeywell as responsible for the contamination, but no official connection has been made between that contamination and the cancers in your village, right?
Yeah, they've named them as responsible, which pretty much a foregone conclusion because of how close they are really to the wells.
So Michael Hickey, in many ways, part of the problem here is that you have a chemical that was used with no proof that it's safe or dangerous, right? Nobody had to prove it was safe before they could start using it at these two companies and before it ultimately got into the water supply.
Yeah, correct. Absolutely. There wasn't any test done in the beginning, I'm sure. You know, Teflon's been around for 60 years, 65 years at this point in time.
Do you think that you would have gotten attention for your story if Flint hadn't happened and the contamination there in Michigan? What do you think when you watch that story coming from Michigan?
I do think that, you know, Governor Cuomo jumped on board this because he didn't want another situation like Flint.
So the governor and the state have dedicated $10 million from the state's super fund to help with the cleanup. Is that enough in your view?
Probably not. $10 million, I think it's a good start for where we have to go. Need to relocate a new water supply first, as we are so close right now with our current wells to Saint-Gobain. So that'll be step one. But then there's also private wells on the outside of the village, which the governor said that he would want to put on the carbon systems into their homes as well. So $10 million really is kind of a start.
Now, you've also talked a lot about foot dragging from local officials, pushback from your own government. Does that mean that political action is coming in Hoosick Falls?
Yeah, I imagine there will be some sort of action done. It was hard, really hard in the beginning, probably November of this year. The EPA came out with a letter. You know, they were saying, don't drink with it, don't cook with it. And yet the Department of Health was giving out a letter at the same meeting that we were at and saying that the chemical was completely fine and it's safe up to 50,000 parts per trillion. So the Department of Health and the EPA haven't really been on the same page during this entire process, which is really unfortunate because I think it's hard on the level where we're at being, you know, smaller government, it's really hard to get through the multiple layers and get on the correct page with everybody. I really think that that was one of the obstacles as well, that the EPA and the Department of Health really weren't on the same page.
I mean, at the end of the day, Michael Hickey, a resident like you shouldn't have to order testing kits from Canada and test the water himself to prove to everybody that there is a problem.
You know, I think this process was handled relatively awful since the beginning. You know, the EPA, I think when they found out about this, I think they did a good job. You know, we never wanted to get legal involved in this. What really the goal was in the beginning was to go in after even the testing was done and say, you know, here's the folder, here's the information, you should handle this and quickly.
The water supply in Hoosick Falls, New York, is contaminated. The Environmental Protection Agency has named two companies as responsible, and it's local citizens like Michael Hickey who had to do the testing themselves and raise the alarms. Michael Hickey of Hoosick Falls, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Online harassment has become an ugly part of internet culture, and some parts of the internet have proven to be more potentially ugly than others, especially for women. Computer and video games are an estimated $91 billion industry. In the summer of 2014, an online game developer and reviewer named Zoe Quinn had a breakup with her boyfriend. That boyfriend retaliated by publishing intimate details about Zoe online. After that, mobs of online users got involved, some of them raining down harassments and threats on Zoe Quinn. The whole affair became known as Gamergate. Last year, Zoe Quinn filed a lawsuit to prevent her ex from commenting on the controversy and stirring up more harassment against her. But this week, Quinn asked the district attorney in Massachusetts to withdraw that criminal case. Gamergate and the subsequent lawsuits have opened up a lot of questions about online harassment of women, of course, but also about free speech and how far the law can go in stopping threats or those who may instigate them. Here's Zoe Quinn.
I don't think the courts are ready to even deal with this, quite frankly. I think that all of the education that we see in the public about the internet not mattering, about, you know, all of just the misunderstandings, treating the internet like a magical alternate universe where nothing matters, means that for me, it doesn't feel like a battle worth fighting.
That's Zoe Quinn in an interview with the Washington Post this week on her decision to end her criminal case. Here to talk about what the law in its current form can and cannot do to protect the targets of online harassment are Danielle Citron. She's a professor of law at the University of Maryland. And also Brianna Wu, a games developer, a journalist, and a podcaster. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having us.
Brianna, for those who have followed Gamergate, they'll know that you've also been the target of online harassment and threats after you got involved. When did the Gamergate mobs turn on you, and what happened?
Well, you know, Zoe is kind of the spark that started this in the public consciousness, but she's also part of a trend that had been happening to women in the game industry throughout most of 2014. I had been speaking out on seeing some of my friends targeted, and eventually they went after me as well. I've had over 200 death threats in the last year and a half. I get rape threats constantly. I had my college call me 3 weeks ago and tell me Gamergate was trying to impersonate me to get my college records and release them.
Daniel Citron, professor of law. Zoe's ex-boyfriend kind of ranted online about her and their relationship, but he didn't threaten her. But others, a lot of others, then did threaten her. Does this present a legal problem when it comes to enforcement? Because harassment and threats are already illegal.
Right. So harassment requires, if you're going to be convicted of harassment, the state's got to prove that someone intentionally, repeatedly, persistently targeted the person with speech that we can punish. And so some of the problem when you have like a huge collective of people targeting a specific person is that it may be that any given person in the mob may contribute a little to the abuse, but not one person is responsible for persistent targeted abuse, right? They may contribute one or two comments, but is that harassment? It might not be, right? It might not arise to that sort of persistent, intentionally causing someone emotional distress and the fear of physical harm. And that is that really complicates things for law enforcement.
So what does that mean then for victims? Does that mean that because it's a mob and not one person, you just have to deal with it or get offline? Or is way to go after the fomenters, the instigators, the people who are whipping up the mob, if you can even do that?
Law has great potential here. But, you know, as we've seen, it's a blunt instrument. Sometimes it fails us, right? So that, you know, when we saw it in Zoe's case, she gave up because it just became too much for herself and her loved ones to bear. So we have laws like criminal solicitation laws. The problem sometimes is, and I'm just going to echo both what Zoe and Brianna were saying, is that sometimes it's really hard to educate law enforcement. They need a lot of training to understand the real significance of this kind of behavior and its real world impact. And so that really presents problems, not only if you have all the evidence and you can trace all of the posts to specific individuals, and even if they all are engaging in prescribable conduct like a true threat, it may be that law enforcement feels outgunned.
Brianna, let's take a step back from the law just for one second and get to the bottom of how this whole thing started. In your case and in Zoe's case, what was your crime? What did you do wrong that got the mobs against you?
I think you have to take a step back and kind of think about the state of the game industry. So in 1985, Nintendo made a very deliberate choice to only market video games towards boys between 5 and 10 years old. And this seemingly simple choice has deeply affected our industry for the last 30 years. It's considered a very, very male pastime. I think the average person can look at video games and understand we have some extreme problems in the way that we represent women. So what has happened is for 30 years, video games are perceived by a certain portion of gamers to be their clubhouse. So now that the video game industry is changing and we have a lot more women developers, women journalists, women CEOs like me, that is very, very threatening to a certain portion of gamer. So our crime is simply being a woman in this field and speaking to our lived experience and asking the industry to do better.
Daniel Citron, it seems like a lot of law enforcement is kind of a club too. And I don't mean to be pejorative, but I wonder if a mostly male police force or a mostly male FBI has a real sense of how this problem affects women when they're harassed.
I mean, that's definitely part of it. Social attitudes are sort of long been a problem. We think about the way we address domestic violence, of course, in the home. It was a family problem. It was no big deal. Why don't you just leave if you don't like it? Those same kinds of attitudes really infect how law enforcement responds to online harassment. You know, in my book, I sort of document ways in which, you know, law enforcement will tell victims, turn your computer off. You know, boys will be boys. It's no big deal. I think we're making a little bit, I want to say very modest progress. We've seen law enforcement, sort of top cops like AG Kamala Harris kind of take on this issue and really think hard about ways in which law enforcement can be better trained.
I also think that the tech industry has a huge role to play. The truth is, social media companies, when I go and speak at these companies and I look around at other software engineers there, these are all, you know, men. And it's usually men with a very specific background, you know, white, straight, you know, kind of engineering. And as a result of that, the policies at Facebook, Reddit, Twitter have been aimed at not protecting anyone else for a very long time. So now this problem has kind of come to a head, and you have these companies looking around and saying, oh my gosh, like, this is terrible. Like, people are getting harassed on our service. So I think there's certainly a law enforcement side to it, but I think there's also a tech industry side.
There's an ongoing reckoning with the harassment of women online, raising questions of culture and raising questions of the law. Daniel Citron is a professor of law at the University of Maryland. Brianna Wu, games developer, podcaster, and CEO. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And here's another cyber story to take with you today. This week, a Los Angeles hospital paid $17,000 to get its electronic medical records back. The hospital was Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center. It was the victim of a malware attack earlier this month, an attack that prevented hospital staff from sharing information electronically. It forced doctors to return to old school pen and paper charts. So much for prevention. The hospital earns an estimated $209 million every year. Apparently not enough to hire a tech-savvy team to protect it from hacks, but enough to pay Bitcoin ransom to get its files back. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry today. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, supporting small business owners across America for over 10 years. With services including business formations and corporate filings, plus independent professionals providing contract review and tax advice, legal help is at LegalZoom.com. And from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at Staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen. Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.